Lawrence Kleinman. Today is October 2nd, 1977. We would like to begin the questioning or the line of discussion with, what was Louisville like when you first came here? And if you could describe the city and the people and the areas.
My parents brought me to Louisville from the east, from New York, in the year 1914. And being the product of an Eastern European segment of the Jewish people, we settled immediately in the then Preston Street area and became affiliated with the Orthodox oriented Jewish community at that time. At the age of 10, I found myself, first of all, being introduced to a Hebrew school that was newly founded by the Jews who were interested in Jewish learning. There seemed to be a strong recognition of Zionism and the value of Hebrew as a language, living as well as biblical. And the Hebrew school, which I attended from 10 to the age of 13, was founded by Rabbi Zarchi and by the learned and informed Jews of this period and area. The living area of the Jews whom I met was very much like the shtetl which they left behind them in Europe. My father came from the Ukraine, and I met some of his relatives who came from a similar background. They were not too learned in secular matters, but they had all gone to cheder or to yeshiva, and they had all made Yiddish their common tongue, although they may have understood Polish and Russian. They transacted their lives in Yiddish, whether it was in business or in the shul or with each other as tradesmen. The segment of people that I knew tended to be employees of tailor shops, small merchants like the butcher and the milkman and the baker. Some of them had one thing in common, that they started with a pack on their back and went to peddling in the outskirts of the city. Others were craftsmen, shoemakers, tailors, and all of them had one thing in common, they were poor. Even as relates to that period of time. And they tended to reenact their lives as they lived in Europe. They had a common interest in music, but it was not popular music. It was the record on the Victrola, principally Chazanische pieces. And at that time, it was common for every Jew to know the nature of a Chazan quartin, of a Chazan-like cantor,
Gessler Rosenblatt,
the various coloratura type of singers, and other than that, operatic records. It was very common to have a Caruso or a Shaliapin in the records of a Victrola at home. What was also very common is almost in every home an effort for a piano. And with it came Jewish music as well as contemporary music. And everybody seemed at that time to me to be performing rather than to be listening. They sang and they played. My first experience in the synagogue was in the choir. And synagogues were poor. My father belonged to the poorest of the poor, to the then Beis Medrash HaGadol, which later united with B'nai Yaakov and became Knesset Israel in 1928. But until that time, everything about the shul, and the shul was the principal life. There was a YMHA at that time, but it was not generally attended by the Orthodox Jews as such. They couldn't afford to pay dues. The dues in the synagogue were $6 a year, which included the right to a burial plot. But that being insufficient, they had to make collections, they had to have picnics, they had to have all kinds of efforts to raise money, including donations. And this went not only for the shul, it was a problem for the Talmud Torah, and even the city rabbi, Rabbi Zarchi, who was recognized by all the synagogues, had to be subsidized by a collection device. Every week, the stalwarts of his support would go around collecting enough money to pay him his week's wages, which in those days was that of a poor working man. The whole way of life was poor, but we didn't know it. We thought we lived very richly because Friday night was a special celebration. Every holiday was observed. And nobody had a transportation problem. We lived within two blocks of everything. So we didn't have to have carriages. There were no cars. The only one who owned a horse was the bread driver and the milkman and the possibly the butcher who had to go buy his meat. The shochet was on Preston Street, and the households were occupied with bringing the chickens to the shochet and having to pluck the chicken themselves. Most of the homes were observant, although they may not have been very ardently religious. They observed as a matter of course, purely as a continuum from their European background, so that the homes tended to be kosher because they dealt with each other. And the Jewish butcher had only kosher meat. The idea of treif or non-kosher was an abhorrence without reason. It was not because they had reasoned it out to be a proper way of life. It was done as a matter of faith. And everything was done as a matter of faith because that's all the poor people had. They had no insurance, so they organized a Chevra Kedisha who buried them. They couldn't go out and buy expensive cemetery lots, so the each synagogue had a little plot, even if it was the size of a little farmhouse. And the life, the community life of the Orthodox element at that time was tended to be very small, very narrow, very self-contained. And everything was brought from Europe, including practically the ghetto wall. Families tended to stay with each other. Children didn't move away when they were married. Marriages were more or less arranged, although not professionally, by a shadchan. And the home, the community life in the home was a patriarchal type of existence. The influence of the mother was tremendous, but always done in a self-effacing manner. The synagogue was attended. if for no other reason that there was no other place to go. The Jew of that group was not athletically inclined. He didn't intermarry, he didn't intermingle, he didn't interdate. So that a social evening was spent by simply walking a door away or a block away and meeting with someone else sitting out on his doorstep. The families were pretty much self-contained because they got here by bringing each other over from Europe. They introduced each other to whatever communal life was here, both secular and non-secular. The sermons in the synagogue were all in Yiddish, interspersed with Hebraic references, Bilbo. And the big advent and the big upheaval, perhaps, in our synagogue life occurred when we brought, quote, an English-speaking rabbi into the shul for the first time. He was a yeshiva-trained man, and he was a foreigner. He was a Palestinian, and his English was a slanted English, but it was done in order to retain the attention of the young generation, who could hardly understand the sermons because of their depth and their philosophy and their constant referral in Hebrew to Talmudic terms that the young growing generation didn't really understand. Our Hebrew education extended to 13 or 14 years, and while it was a more intensive education than is given today, in the sense that we were taught conversational Hebrew, we were taught the Bible by translating it Ivris be Ivris, so that we had a pretty good knowledge of the language, the alphabet, the meaning of the words, and could use it in an archaic sort of form to put together a translation of another Hebrew sentence. But we were really not versed deeply. We barely skimmed through the Chumash and barely touched on the Talmud and the Gemara. Our lives became interrupted when we entered high school and became interested in all the activities that the outside world at that time offered. When the two Orthodox shuls with which I was familiar, the B'nai Yaakov and the Beis Medrash HaGadol, merged, they built another synagogue in which the size of the place could accommodate both memberships. And typically of that time, we began to increase our dues as the congregation began to prosper. And as I recall it, $24 a year was the standard goal of the synagogue. Not everybody could afford that. And again, we supplemented synagogue funds, first by taking a mortgage, which was hard to pay, and secondly, by running picnics and programs and Purim plays and indoor festivities to raise money to pay off what was then a horrendous indebtedness, something like $100,000.
This was the structure on Floyd Street?
This is the Floyd and Jacob Street structure. And it became such a burdensome thing that when the Depression hit, we lost the services of the rabbi who had built the place, and we took on another English-speaking rabbi, and that was the development of a concept of trying to reach the young generation on their own terms. We there was an upheaval when sermons were preached in English. It was foreign to the Jewish speaking community. Not all of these Yiddish speaking people had learned enough English to understand the sermon. And there was a restlessness. They wanted to hang on to the traditions that they had lived. They wanted their children to be educated, but the children themselves didn't have enough lingual ability to stay within Yiddish and Hebrew. And the young people asked for a more understandable kind of presentation of Yiddishism and the faith. It became a sort of a schism between what we called the old generation and the new generation. And the small town shtetl type of Jew found himself at a loss to master the gap both of age and of language and of custom and of social environment. I think our fathers did a heroic job of keeping us within the bounds of our faith, considering the various difficulties that they had to overcome just to orient themselves to American life, in addition to the difficulty of making a living. So there came a time when the young men could not understand why their entire families should not sit by their sides in synagogue. And they sought for a compromise with the old ways, a modification of what is known as the mechitza. And the very, very hardcore of Orthodoxy felt that this was a crumbling away of the defenses against differentiation from the old ways. They treated it pretty much as a sort of a Hellenistic approach to Judaism, and they felt like it was a scheme to change the Orthodox shul into a temple, and from there to total assimilation. And they resisted any move, even though it was within the terms of authoritative halacha, to accept seating on the same floor in the synagogue. The synagogue found itself in a paradoxical situation, in that the biggest attendants of the services were women. And they were compelled to go up on the second floor in a balcony and look down on a synagogue of men that was becoming thinner and thinner because the men drifted away from Sabbath observance. And the synagogue found that it could rely more on the women to maintain not only their attendance, but the attendance of the children. So they called on the rabbinate to alleviate the difference so that they should have a sense of davening together, of praying together, of being together and observing together, and within the bounds of Orthodox halacha. And the idea of a mechitza was broached within our synagogue. Authorities were consulted at that time as to what would constitute a proper mechitza. And even the consultation was denied by those people who felt like this was an infringement of their basic traditional rights. And after this upheaval, a schism developed, and there was a separation of membership from that synagogue, which went in two ways. Part of our members went to the conservative movement. Another part went to another Orthodox movement, which maintained a different kind of separation or mechitza. and on the technicality of how the people should be seated. Aside from mixed seating, the synagogue had a critical period, and it developed the leaving of one rabbi, the coming of another, the leaving of that rabbi, the coming of another. But it was as if the assimilatory influences of an American society were trying to break open some of the traditional spiritual ghettos, mental ghettos, as well as physical ghettos, and reorganize Jewish living. I found myself here in Louisville confronted with people of goodwill who could not or would not understand the need for, quote, change. Not in beliefs, not in basic religious concept, certainly not in Yiddishkeit, but in the ability to cohabit and to correlate with variations of opinion. In spite of the fact that everything that they had studied Talmudically in their schoolings and under the rabbis who lectured them was always presented with the opposing opinions of the various schools of thought, whether it was Hillel or Shammai or any of the other great authorities in Judaism, Talmud being full of differences of opinion, more so than unanimity of opinion, did not seem to have a reasoning effect on people who knew only the immediate narrow concepts of their own lives and were afraid of losing their children. This is my introduction to the small segment, certainly not to the whole city of Louisville, to the small segment of traditional Jews who came from East Europe and had to scratch out a living from the very bottom up. Peddlers, artisans, craftsmen, tailors, shoemakers, melamdim, shochtim, rabbis, chazanim. They had a great feeling, even those Jews who didn't observe well, they had a great feeling for Yiddishkeit. And as poor as the synagogues were, they didn't hesitate to spend thousands of dollars for the importation of a well-known cantor to preside over the high holidays. They maintained a choir which was not volunteer. They paid a choir, and it measured in terms of thousands of dollars in order to have a beautiful synagogue service. All of them wanted to retain the form of their spirit. Not all of them wanted to observe the forms, even though they retained the spirit. So that a good percentage of the young generation of the early part of the century, dating from what I met here in 1910 and going up into the Depression period of the 30s, was very much enthused about expressing themselves artistically, expressing themselves in the presentation of their holidays, of their synagogue service, and they embellished the home with music. They sang the songs, and they patronized the Jewish artists that came to the city, whether they were cantors like Rosenblatt and others.
Rosenblatt came here?
One time. They imported various artistic men from the theater, from a comedian like Menachem Skolnick, and other, I think Schwartz came here one time from the Yiddish Theater. And they would go to other cities to attend Jewish concerts, Jewish theater. They bought Yiddish records, not necessarily synagogue records. They bought the Jewish comedian and the Jewish singer and the tear-jerking records. And they had in their homes everything from Jewish opera to Jewish comedy. And the homes were always utilized in the evening for interfamily communication, for get-togethers that included singing, chanting, and storytelling. It was a transformation from the Yiddish little town, whether it was Vilna, Ravne, Tuchin, or any of the other small communities and the larger communities. And they were represented by their own dialects in Yiddish. They had their segmentation. The Galiciano was something apart from a Lutvak. The Lutvak was something apart from a Romanian. And all of these were certainly apart from the Deutsche Yehudim, the German Jew. And the same differences that existed in Europe between the Haskola movement and Hasidic movement translated itself here in Lutheran in a diminishing sort of way. It wasn't quite, perhaps, as ardent a manifestation, but it was very, very Jewish, from the olive base to the way the housewives baked and kept the house. Not synagogues, which are the Anshe Sfard, the then existing Beis HaMedrash HaGadol and B'nai Yaakov Shul, the four Orthodox groups. The congregations were too poor to each of them support a rabbi at the beginning when they first got started. So they used a common rabbi who was the city rabbi. At that time when I came to Loyola, it was Rabbi Zaki, who alternated his services for the various synagogues on the holiday occasions, and also served the entire community when matters of religious importance came up. He served not only at weddings and other occasions, but in those days, the rabbi was consulted on many questions other than religious questions. There were questions, of course, of kashrus and of halacha and so forth. But basically, he was a scholarly man. He had a chevra shas, which was the group of Jews who had enough learning to sit with the rabbi and study a little Gemara or Talmud or Chumash, as the case may be. And Rabbi Zaki served as a very dignified and very erudite person, but spoke no English, and he served the Yiddish speaking community. He was called the city rabbi, and he served that way. As the Orthodox synagogues grew, and each one felt the need for having congregational religious leadership that they could fall back on without having to split the services of the rabbi, each began to hire and retain a rabbi of their own. The city rabbi still served as the head of the Vada Kashrus. He still served as the founder and head of the Talmud Torah, the religious head. and he still served for anything that would resemble a Din Torah or a judgment relating to marital affairs, the granting of a divorce, and the other Jewish problems that required the judgment of a rabbi. It was common in those days for a shechet or a woman to bring the rabbi a chicken to determine whether the chicken was treif or not treif, whether the utensils that were used had been properly koshered. And all of this was done practically in the rabbi's house. His parlor was the counseling room for that part of the community which used him. It was only in the latter years, beginning with the end of World War I, that every synagogue had its own rabbi. This was not always true of Agudas Achim, which was a rather small congregation and used a rabbi intermittently for holiday occasions and for special services. The shochet of the city was also the mohel. It was used for circumcisions. And the rabbi acted as a mashgiach over the butcher shops, over the shechet.
This was Rabbi Zarchi?
Rabbi Zarchi, or someone whom he designated, who would be a competent person to supervise. He tended to be, to stay in his own quarters and depend on a mashgiach for those functional duties which required a lot of time and which he couldn't spread himself out on. But everybody relied on him as the Orthodox city rabbi, the head of the Orthodox community. He was a very erudite and very revered person, and he lived very close to his religious functions. He did identify with the young people. He had a love for children, and it was realized in his founding of a wonderful Hebrew school in his day. But it was not merely the difference in age which separated him from the younger generation. It was the entire complexity of a difference of language, customs, environment, and the field of the whole communal living was a non-synagogue oriented life. Everybody observed the holidays. Everybody venerated the customs, and then went out into a non-Jewish life, many of them, to make a living. And it was hard to reconcile the difference between a confined, ghetto-like physical and mental attitude with the American way of life, which these immigrant peoples had to become a part of. They managed to present a dual face, to meet the outside world in its American manner, and come home and live an intensely Jewish life in a Yiddish manner. Their children found it more difficult. In the 20s, the children began to go away for schooling rather than remain in the city for secular schooling. Even in the case of those few children who went to a yeshiva, to do so they had to leave home. So the gap that existed between the parent generation and the new American generation was not merely one of age. It was not merely the mentality between young and old. it was also the difference between a very European kind of approach to life, to living, to customs, to food, to shelter, to clothing, to style, as compared to the American system which these children were born to. This was the conflict within a conflict. Not necessarily open, not necessarily hostile. The conflict was not imposed by the people who felt it. It was imposed by the environment in which they were born and in which they found themselves. And some of the Orthodox element could try to dress themselves mentally and physically and bodily in the American style. Others persisted in what was then a very marked difference, like the maintaining of a beard, the maintaining of the wearing of tzitzis, the constant observance of carrying the head covering, the attendance of prayer meetings in the mornings, the services, and even in the home, or simply attending synagogue as a believer rather than a participant. These differences didn't happen in one day or one week or one month. It grew as the young generation grew. And it is hard for me to look back and recognize my synagogue as the one in which I was first affiliated as a member of the choir and as a member of the congregation as I grew older. I find the Jews to be the same. Their appearance is different. Their way of life is different. It seems that it's an inevitable kind of difference, if nothing else, than in the manner in which it finds expression. Our children are not as exposed today to the Yiddishkeit of the previous generations. On the other hand, there is a much greater cognition of the Hebraic quality of Jewish life, and this has to be attributable to the establishment of the Jewish state. Our children today are perhaps more Israelite than Yiddish. They are more Hebrew than Jewish, and they are more Zionistically oriented than they are synagogue oriented, but they are more Zionistically oriented than traditionally oriented.
If you don't mind, I'd like to go back to saying you were mentioning the Vada Kashrus.
Yes.
And if you could go into that.
The Vada Kashrus was composed of the observing Jews who supervised Kashrus. It was the community organization which ensured that there would be kosher meat, kosher chicken, kosher killing, that a shochet would be supported, and who set the fees for Kashrus, both for the slaughtering of animals and for the killing of chickens. And there was no other organization to pay for a shochet's salary or his quarters. There was no other organization to arrange for a slaughterhouse, to set aside a portion of the slaughterhouse for Jewish killing. And in a small city like Louisville, the slaughtering of kosher animals was a great problem in those days because it was a costly experiment for the slaughterhouse that was not a kosher slaughterhouse. The problem was always that not only was there a fee for slaughtering, that the slaughterhouse used to pay their own employees, but the manner of killing was such that the shochet found himself killing much more kosher meat than the city could possibly use, simply because there was only one kosher liver to a calf. But there could be requirements for 10 kosher livers in a certain butcher shop. So the shochet had to kill 10 calves in order to provide 10 livers, even though the rest of the calves were not consumed. So this was expensive in many ways. It meant that not only the hindquarters, but many forequarters of animals were sold to non-kosher butchers who wouldn't pay for kashrus, who wouldn't pay for the fee of killing the kosher. In fact, there was a deterioration of the skins, the hides of cows, of cattle, which were killed kosher because the slaughtering by the neck spoiled some of the leather. It meant that the skin was not used as an entire skin. It couldn't be used as a totally whole skin. It was, in a sense, damaged. There was also the question of getting in the way of regular production. There had to be, the kosher supervision had to be under the auspices of a mashgiach, who would make certain that no non-kosher meat would enter into it, which would not be true in an entirely kosher establishment. So the Vada Kashrus was a group of volunteer participants, pretty much as the Chevra Kedisha was volunteer. They never were paid for their services. And they supervised, first of all, the collection of funds. They eventually did it by putting a poundage tax on all kosher meats that were stamped kosher by the shochet. This butcher paid for the slaughtering and the koshering of the meat and passed it on to the consumer. And that accounted for a difference in price between kosher meat and non-kosher meat. And since it was imposed on a very poor community, because the non-Orthodox element of Jews would be less apt to use the Jewish butcher. The temple tended to stay away from the use of the Jewish butcher, although it was not absolute, there was no prohibition against it. But many of the temple members felt no need for observing kashrus in the first place. So this also had a fencing-in effect on the communal life of the Orthodox Jewish community. The same Vada Kashrus that preserved kashrus was the organization that went around and collected weekly for the rabbi's salary. It may seem today like a very undignified way to support a rabbi, to go from door to door and ask for the rabbi's stipend to be subsidized. But in those days, it was considered a mitzvah. And it was one of the peculiar things that I found, as compared to modern day, in the Jewish community. It was very simplified and perhaps under-organized, as compared to a highly organized community today. When a charity had to be done, it was done on a personal basis. If there was a family in need, we went from door to door and collected money for that family. The donors didn't always know who the donees were, but they knew that they were helping out for a cause, for a case of sickness or death, or even to help marry off a poor child. Certainly to subsidize a Talmud Torah for a child that couldn't afford to pay tuition. And even membership in the synagogue was not dependent on dues, and people who couldn't afford to pay dues didn't pay dues, but they were still members of a synagogue. So that charity was very personalized in that day, and it was only crystallized in organizational form with the entrance of America, and perhaps 2 or 3 years before then, into World War I. Then the overseas demands for charity, the tzedakah that had to be sent to Europe for orphans and for widows and for the wounded and the maimed. They were called milchama karbonos. And that constituted a collective charitable effort which embraced all the Jews of the community of all the various synagogues. And this led to the Federation of Charities, which began to consolidate all the efforts at charity and took away the personal involvement on a one-to-one basis of charity. Perhaps the beginning of charitable cohesive efforts began with Zionism, with the Jewish National Fund, with the establishment of a fund for the purchase of land and the reforestation of Israel, then known as Palestine. The existence of charity, I found here and I've always been aware of, going back into the history of my family as it was told to me. And tzedakah was a very common exercise in Jewish life, I'm sure all over, and I found it here. So if a poor family didn't have for Friday night or for Seder night, if they didn't have matzah or they didn't have a challah, the neighbors who knew it provided it. Many of them had to bake it themselves because they didn't have the money to go out and buy a challah. So part of their baking constituted charity. There were some people, women especially, who were involved in this personal bringing of support to the very poor and to the afflicted as a weekly effort, actually physically carrying a basket of food from door to door to the needy. And these were a particularly unusual sect of women. There were a handful of them, but they would go on the then known Haymarket, and everybody knew that they were alone, that they were baking and cooking and making meals for sick people and for poor people. The merchants would give them food either at a nominal cost or outright, and they would prepare the Shabbos each week. And I could enumerate a number of them, but it was not peculiar to just one family. It was called tzedakah in the personal sense, but at the same time, in every Jewish home, I saw a little blue box where a penny was dropped in or a nickel was dropped in to express a sense of charity and to expiate for someone getting well and to contribute to the building of Israel. There were hospital funds that were also supported. I found a Jewish hospital here, which was maintained and supported not only by Orthodox Jews, but by the general community. But other than that, the community tended to be a personally developed and personally conducted livelihood and living experiment. It was not generally organized on a professional basis. The organizational work was done very much by the original migrators to the city. It began with a Young People's Hebrew Association. It began with a Jewish hospital. It began with a B'nai B'rith. And these were the extraneous forms of community living. in the Orthodox element of the city, community collaboration began primarily with World War I, as I saw it, in Louisville. It tended to take away from the synagogue eventually the social life of the Orthodox community and commingle it with the conservative and reform movement in a community center. And it tended to de-intensify what was considered social life among Orthodox Jews, whether it be attending dances as compared to a synagogue picnic, going on trips and engaging in athletic sports, because there was now a center in which that could be done. But I think that the original Jewish settler of the poor Orthodox division of Jews didn't miss the community life. He had a full life, but he had it in the synagogue. The synagogue was his center. And that's why the way of life was so concentrated in various types of observance and of conformity to tradition. The basics were all the same with all of them. And they had one thing in common, a tremendous sense of responsibility for each other. Jews tended not to apply for charity, to community charities. They tended to take care of their own to the best of their poor abilities. So if we didn't have an old people's home, it was unheard of for a mother or a father not to be housed with their children. If the hospital wasn't available to them, the bedroom became the hospital and the doctor made house calls. Or the primitive things that they knew to apply were used for helping the sick.
I want to interject right here because we're nearing the end of the tape at this side. Getting back to the Federation and the depersonalization of Jewish charity with the advent of World War I, wondering along these lines, as this, you say the center began to, or the YMHA began to supplant the synagogue as the center of activities. When did this concept of a whole Jewish community, as opposed to the Orthodox Jewish and the Reform Jewish and conservative Jewish community begin? When did it begin to be a whole Jewish community?
The business of the coalescence of segments probably started with World War I in this sense. Until then, the German Jew found the Orthodox Jew rather alien. The Orthodox Jew found the German Jew rather supercilious. Because the German Jew came to America a generation earlier, perhaps more than a generation, he tended to be the more affluent part of the community. He had already become Americanized. He had acquired substance. And to him, the Orthodox Jew was a reintrusion into the American scene of a standard of life and an occupational thrust that he was removed from by several generations. He had no immediate recollection of his forefathers coming down the Ohio River from Philadelphia by way of the Gratz family, by way of the various for institutes that sent dealers down to deal with the Indians, and he was already evolved from the posture of a newcomer. He was settled. He thought he had roots here. The Orthodox Jew came in as the peddler again, a sort of a reinstitution of poor origin, a reminder that Jews were wanderers and poor people, as the Western world knew it in the 16th, 1700s, 1800s. Also, the German Jew had begun to establish himself as part of the establishment here in America. He had already proven that he didn't have horns and that he was to be trusted and he was to be understood. And they brought with him a measure of culture into the American scene. The Russian Jew, the Ukrainian Jew, the Romanian, the Austrian, the Hungarian, and the Polish Jew had to first prove that. And he didn't prove it immediately because he was engaged, first of all, with the critical thing of making a living. He proved it by sending his children to a school in which they served to be bright and attentive and hardworking, and tended to excel by dint of hard work. And because of the tremendous urge of Jews to educate their children. This difference of approach, this difference of time lag between the German immigration and the Eastern European immigration made us alien in appearance, in tongue, in habit, in custom, in style, and in work approach to the German Jew, who considered himself as much Germanic as Jewish. It took an upheaval like World War I to reconcile those differences, because it then became critically true and apparent that a Jew was a Jew. If not in his own eyes, if he found a difference with his Jewish neighbor, the Gentile world didn't. And whether he was a German Jew or a Russian Jew, anything which was for or against him acted in the same degree. The common purpose, which evolved from World War I, beginning with the efforts of Herzl, Chaim Weizmann, and others, to establish the political existence of the Jewish people. This was acceptable by all Orthodox Jews and by most, and I emphasize most, because there were many Reformed Jews who could not see the need or the desirability for establishing a political entity that was called Jewish. They feared it because they thought they were already well established. With the drive towards a common purpose in the establishment of a homeland, for the first time, German Jews, Russian Jews, Jews of all national origin did have a common purpose. Once the purpose was common, then it became a little more kosher for an Orthodox boy to date a Reformed girl, and vice versa. It wasn't very swallowable. It was a little hard to take for many people on both sides. But they then began to commingle and to co-marry and to live together with a greater measure of understanding of each other and of tolerance for each other. Until then, each of these groups operated and functioned and tried to sustain themselves separately. Each was afraid that the other would acquire what they didn't like in the other side. The apparent difference that has developed here in Louisville has been wiped away by an erosion on both sides. The Reformed Jew began to find the Orthodox Jew acceptable in his social circle, which was not always true. The Orthodox Jew began to feel that perhaps the Reformed Jew was not the antithesis of what he stood for. And there has been a homogenization in the last 40 years, which began with World War I and was culminated with World War II, and certainly became very, very prevalent, beginning with the establishment of the State of Israel. Very few Reformed Jews today feel that there is no need for a State of Israel. Many of them felt that before World War I, perhaps most of them. And this includes even the Reformed rabbis, which is not true today. So the period in which I lived in Louisville saw this upheaval and change and development of an sect acceptance, which has come about with the third generation from the beginning of the century. I have lived the last 60 years, 65 years, during this change. And looking back at it, I would say that the forces of assimilation would probably have affected all types of Judaism in relation to the Gentile world if they didn't have these differences amongst themselves with which to assimilate. There is, I believe, in Louisville, less interfaith assimilation, although I'm aware of the intermarriages that have occurred, for the fact that there was an assimilating process going on between Orthodox and non-Orthodox Jews. It was a question of going with Jacob or going with Esau. And Esau was still a cousin. The Jews of Louisville today, as I see them, meet with each other with less embarrassment and less doubt and certainly less hostility for the fact that this stringent kind of judgment has stopped in great degree between all fragments of the Jewish population. I think our judgments are no longer as related to country of origin. We, in the Orthodox group, tended to question where a person came from.
Kalitzianer and Litvak.
Yes. And we had a judgment. And this judgment was a stereotype just like the Gentile world has stereotyped the Jew. It was stereotyped by characteristics, which were of course superficial and based on mannerisms more than anything else. The German Jew was stiff-necked and very bigoted and very narrow and very snobby. The Russian Jew was not refined, he was not cultured, he was not learned. The Polish Jew was very sharp, very hard to deal with, and used his learning to take advantage. The Galicianer Jew was a peasant. The Lithuanian Jew was a member of the Haskalah movement. He was a narrow yeshivnik. The Ukrainian Jew could be a chassid or a misnagat. These were the various typifications that took place, which were pure stereotypes. Certainly not established by any studies or profound. We had these designations. If he is a Sephardic Jew, then an Ashkenazi Jew can't deal with him. If he was a German Jew, he wouldn't have anything to do with you. Now, all these various narrow differentiations seem to have been blurred. And I think in that sense, the melting pot did take place in Louisville in the last 60 years.
And you think that is possibly when around World War One, and between World War One and World War II, when the YMHA became more of a community organization as opposed to mostly for German Jews?
Yes, the difference was when the community center made more of its communal life than an athletic association. It really started out as a Jewish athletic organization, and it satisfied the need of the young Jew who gathered together for even intramural sports, body development, and some of the arts and some of the crafts. But as the Orthodox Jew was invited in, the community center began to function as a community Jewish project which embraced much more than just athletics. I think that the role of athletics became less dominant, and that the role of social activities, arts, crafts, social gatherings, and the use of a common place for meeting, which took over much of the activities of the synagogue and the